This is Audible.
You're listening to the audio production of Heaven is for Real, a little boy's outstanding story of his trip to heaven and back by Todd Burpo with Lynn Vincent, published by Thomas Nelson and read by Stu Gray.
I tell you the truth. Unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Jesus of Nazareth. Acknowledgements. In telling Colton's story, we have been afforded the chance to not just work with dedicated professionals, but with real and caring people. Sure, we have been impressed with their expertise, but Sonia and I have been more delighted by their character and their hearts. Phil McCallum, Joel Needler, Lynn Vincent, and Debbie Wickwire have not just invested their own lives into the making of this book, they have also enriched our family. Without their enormous efforts and sensitive spirits, Heaven is for Real would have never developed so wonderfully. We thank God daily for assembling these gifted and talented people to help us tell Colton's story. Each one has been a blessing to us. Sonia and I count it a wonderful privilege to call them our friends. Prologue. Angels at Arby's. The 4th of July holiday calls up memories of patriotic parades, the savory scents of smoky barbecue, sweet corn, and night skies bursting with showers of light. But for my family, the July 4th weekend of 2003 was a big deal for other reasons. My wife Sonia and I had planned to take the kids to visit Sonia's brother Steve and his family in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. It would be our first chance to meet our nephew Bennett, born 2 months earlier. Plus, our kids, Cassie and Colton, had never been to the falls before. Yes, there really is a Sioux Falls in Sioux Falls. But the biggest deal of all was this. This trip would be the first time we'd left our hometown of Imperial, Nebraska, since a family trip to Greeley, Colorado in March had turned into the worst nightmare of our lives. To put it bluntly, the last time we had taken a family trip, one of our children almost died. Call us crazy, but we were a little apprehensive this time, almost to the point of not wanting to go. Now, as a pastor, I'm not a believer in superstition. Still, some weird, unsettled part of me felt that if we just hunkered down close to home, we'd be safe. Finally, though, reason and the lure of meeting little Bennett, whom Steve had told us was the world's cutest baby, won out. So we packed up a weekend's worth of paraphernalia in our blue Ford Expedition and got our family ready to head north. Sonia and I decided the best plan would be to get most of the driving done at night. That way, even though Colton would be strapped into his car seat against his 4-year-old I'm a big kid will, at least he'd sleep for most of the trip. So it was a little after 8 p.m. when I backed the Expedition out of our driveway, steered past Crossroads Wesleyan Church, my pastorate, and hit Highway 61. The night spread clear and bright across the plains, a half moon white against a velvet sky. Imperial is a small farming town tucked just inside the western border of Nebraska. With only 2,000 souls and zero traffic lights, it's the kind of town with more churches than banks, where farmers stream straight off the fields into the family-owned cafe at lunchtime, wearing Wolverine work boots, John Deere ball caps, and a pair of pliers for fence mending hanging off their hips. So Cassie, age 6, and Colton were excited to be on the road to the big city of Sioux Falls to meet their newborn cousin. The kids chattered for 90 miles to the city of North Platte, with Colton fighting action figure superhero battles and saving the world several times on the way. It wasn't quite 10 p.m. when we pulled into the town of about 24,000, whose greatest claim to fame is that it was the hometown of the famous Wild West showman, Buffalo Bill Cody. North Platte would be about the last civilized stop, or at least the last open stop, we'd pass that night as we headed northeast across vast stretches of cornfields, empty of everything but deer, pheasant, and an occasional farmhouse. We had planned in advance to stop there to top off both the gas tank and our bellies. After a fill-up at a Sinclair gas station, we pulled out onto Jeffers Street, and I noticed we were passing through the traffic light, where, if we turned left, we'd wind up at the Great Plains Regional Medical Center. That was where we'd spent 15 nightmarish days in March, much of it on our knees, praying for God to spare Colton's life. God did, but Sonia and I joke that the experience shaved years off our own lives. Sometimes, laughter is the only way to process tough times. So as we passed the turnoff, I decided to rib Colton a little. "Hey, Colton, if we turn here, we can go back to the hospital," I said. "Do you want to go back to the hospital?" Our preschooler giggled in the dark. "No, Daddy, don't send me. Send Cassie. Cassie can go to the hospital." Sitting next to him, his sister laughed. "Nuh-uh, I don't want to go either." In the passenger seat, Sonia turned so that she could see our son, whose car seat was parked behind mine. I pictured his blonde crew cut and his sky blue eyes shining in the dark. "Do you remember the hospital, Colton?" Sonia said. "Yes, Mommy, I remember," he said. "That's where the angel sang to me." Inside the expedition, time froze. Sonia and I looked at each other, passing a silent message. Did he just say what I think he said? Sonia leaned over and whispered, "Has he talked to you about angels before?" I shook my head. "You?" She shook her head. I spotted an Arby's, pulled into the parking lot, and switched off the engine. White light from a street lamp filtered into the expedition. Twisting in my seat, I peered back at Colton. In that moment, I was struck by his smallness, his little boyness. He was really just a little guy who still spoke with an endearing and sometimes embarrassing, call it like you see it, innocence. If you're a parent, you know what I mean. The age where a kid might point to a pregnant woman and ask very loudly, "Daddy, why is that lady so fat?" Colton was in that narrow window of life where he hadn't yet learned either tact or guile. All these thoughts flashed through my mind as I tried to figure how to respond to my 4-year-old's simple proclamation that angels had sung to him. Finally, I plunged in. "Colton, you said that angels sang to you while you were at the hospital?" He nodded his head vigorously. "What did they sing to you?" Colton turned his eyes up and to the right, the attitude of remembering. "Well, they sang, 'Jesus loves me,' and 'Joshua fought the battle of Jericho,'" he said earnestly. "I asked them to sing, 'We will rock you,' but they wouldn't sing that." As Cassie giggled softly, I noticed that Colton's answer had been quick and matter-of-fact, without a hint of hesitation. Sonia and I exchanged glances again. What's going on? Did he have a dream in the hospital? And one more unspoken question. What do we say now? A natural question popped into my head. Colton, what did the angels look like? He chuckled at what seemed to be a memory. Well, one of them looked like Grandpa Dennis, but it wasn't him, 'cause Grandpa Dennis has glasses. Then he grew serious. Dad, Jesus had the angels sing to me because I was so scared. They made me feel better. Jesus? I glanced at Sonia again and saw that her mouth had dropped open. I turned back to Colton. You mean Jesus was there? My little boy nodded as though reporting nothing more remarkable than seeing a ladybug in the front yard. Yeah. Jesus was there. Well, where was Jesus? Colton looked me right in the eye. I was sitting in Jesus's lap. If there are stop buttons on conversations, that was one of them right there. Astonished into speechlessness, Sonia and I looked at each other and passed another silent telegram. Okay, we really need to talk about this. We all piled out of the expedition and trooped into Arby's, emerging a few minutes later with a bag of grub. In between, Sonia and I exchanged whispers. Do you think he really saw angels? And Jesus? I don't know. Was it a dream? I don't know, He seems so sure. Back in the SUV, Sonia passed out roast beef sandwiches and potato cakes, and I ventured another question. Colton, where were you when you saw Jesus? He looked at me as if to say, didn't we just talk about this? At the hospital. You know, when Dr. O'Halloran was working on me? Well, Dr. O'Halloran worked on you a couple of times, remember? I said. Colton had both an emergency appendectomy and then an abdominal clean-out in the hospital. And later, we had taken Colton to have some keloid scarring removed. But that was at Dr. O'Halloran's office. Are you sure it was at the hospital? Colton nodded. Yeah, at the hospital. When I was with Jesus, you were praying, and Mommy was talking on the phone. What? That definitely meant he was talking about the hospital. But how in the world did he know where we had been? But you were in the operating room, Colton, I said. How could you know what we were doing? 'Cause I could see you, Colton said matter-of-factly. I went up out of my body, and I was looking down, and I could see the doctor working on my body, and I saw you and Mommy. You were in a little room by yourself praying, and Mommy was in a different room, and she was praying and talking on the phone. Colton's words rocked me to my core. Sonia's eyes were wider than ever, but she said nothing, just stared at me and absently bit into her sandwich. That was all the information I could handle at that point. I started the engine, steered the expedition back onto the street, and pointed us towards South Dakota. As I hit I-80, pasture lands unrolled on either side, dotted here and there with duck ponds that glinted in the moonlight. By then, it was very late, and soon everyone else was snoozing, as planned. As the road hummed underneath me, I marveled at the things I had just heard. Our little boy had said some pretty incredible stuff, and he had backed it up with credible information, things there was no way he could have known. We had not told him what we were doing while he was in surgery, under anesthesia, apparently unconscious. Over and over I kept asking myself, how could he have known? But by the time we rolled across the South Dakota state line, I had another question. Could this be real? 1. The Coliseum. The family trip when our nightmare began was supposed to be a celebration. In early March 2003, I was scheduled to travel to Greeley, Colorado for a district board meeting of the Wesleyan Church. Beginning the August before, our family had traveled a rocky road. 7 months of back-to-back injury and illness that included a shattered leg, 2 surgeries, and a cancer scare, all of which combined to drain our bank account to the point where I could almost hear sucking sounds when the statements came in the mail. My small pastor's salary hadn't been affected, but our financial mainstay was the overhead garage door business we owned. Our medical trials had taken a heavy toll. By February, though, we seemed to be on the other side of all that. Since I had to travel anyway, we decided to turn the board meeting trip into a kind of marker in our family life, a time to have a little fun, revive our minds and spirits, and start moving forward again with fresh hope. Sonia had heard of a neat place for kids to visit just outside of Denver called the Butterfly Pavilion. Billed as an invertebrate zoo, the Butterfly Pavilion opened in 1995 as an educational project that would teach people about the wonders of insects, as well as marine critters, the kinds that live in tide pools. These days, kids are greeted outside the zoo by a towering and colorful metal sculpture of a praying mantis. But back in 2003, the giant insect hadn't taken up his post yet, so the low brick building about 15 minutes from downtown Denver didn't shout "kid appeal" on the outside. But inside, a world of wonders waited, especially for kids Colton's and Cassie's ages. The first place we stopped was the Coliseum, a room filled with terrariums housing creepy crawly critters from beetles to roaches to spiders. One exhibit, the Tarantula Tower, drew Cassie and Colton like a magnet. This stack of terrariums was, exactly as advertised, a tower of glassed-in habitats containing the kind of furry, thick-legged spiders that either fascinate you or give you the willies. Cassie and Colton took turns climbing a three-step folding stool in order to get a look at the residents of the tarantula tower's upper stories. In one terrarium, a Mexican blonde tarantula squatted in a corner, its exoskeleton covered with what the exhibit placard described as hair in a lovely pale color. Another habitat contained a red and black tarantula native to India. One of the scarier-looking residents was a skeleton tarantula, so named because its black legs were segmented with white bands so that the spider looked a little like an X-ray in reverse. We later heard that this particular skeleton tarantula was a bit of a rebel. Once, she had somehow engineered a jailbreak, invaded the habitat next door, and eaten her neighbor for lunch. As Colton hopped up on the footstool to see what the rogue tarantula looked like, he glanced back at me with a grin that warmed me. I could feel my neck muscles begin to unknot, and somewhere inside me, a pressure valve released, the emotional equivalent of a long sigh. For the first time in months, I felt I could simply enjoy my family. "Wow, look at that one," Cassie said, pointing into one of the terrariums. A slightly gangly 6-year-old, my daughter was as smart as a whip, a trait she got from her mom. Cassie was pointing to the exhibit sign, which read, "Goliath Bird Eater. Females can be over 11 inches long." The one in this tank was only about 6 inches long, but its body was as thick as Colton's wrist. He stared through the glass, wide-eyed. I looked over and saw Sonia wrinkle her nose. I guess one of the volunteer zookeepers saw her expression, too, because he quickly came to the bird eater's defense. "The Goliath is from South America," he said in a friendly, educational tone that said, "They're not as yucky as you think. Tarantulas from North and South America are very docile. You can even hold one right over there." He pointed to where another zookeeper was holding a smaller tarantula in his palm so that a group of kids could take a closer look. Cassie darted across the room to see what all the fuss was about, with Sonia, Colton, and me bringing up the rear. In a corner of the room, decorated to look like a bamboo hut, the keeper was displaying the undisputed star of the Coliseum, Rosie the Spider. A rose-haired tarantula from South America, Rosie was a furry arachnid with a plum-sized body and legs 6 inches long, thick as pencils. But the best thing about Rosie from a kid's point of view was that if you were brave enough to hold her, even for a moment, the zookeeper would award you with a sticker. Now, if you have little kids, you already know that there are times they'd rather have a good sticker than a handful of cash. And this sticker was special. White, with a picture of a tarantula stamped in yellow. It read, "I held Rosie." This wasn't just any old sticker. This was a badge of courage. Cassie bent low over the keeper's hand. Colton looked up at me, blue eyes wide. "Can I have a sticker, Daddy?" "You have to hold Rosie to get a sticker, buddy." At that age, Colton had this precious way of talking, part serious, part breathless golly gee wonder. He was a smart, funny little guy with a black and white way of looking at life. Something was either fun, Legos, or it wasn't, Barbies. He either liked food, steak, or hated it, green beans. There were good guys and bad guys, and his favorite toys were good guy action figures. Superheroes were a big deal to Colton. He took his Spider-Man, Batman, and Buzz Lightyear action figures with him everywhere he went. That way, whether he was stuck in the back seat of the SUV, in a waiting room, or on the floor at the church, he could still create scenes in which the good guys saved the world. This usually involved swords, Colton's favorite weapon for banishing evil. At home, he could be the superhero. I'd often walk into the house and find Colton armed to the teeth, a toy sword tucked through each side of his belt, and one in each hand. "I'm playing Zorro, Daddy. Wanna play?" Now, Colton turned his gaze to the spider in the keeper's hand, and it looked to me like he wished he had a sword right then, at least for moral support. I tried to imagine how huge this spider must look to a little guy who wasn't even 4 feet tall. Our son was all boy, a rough-and-tumble kid who had gotten up close and personal with plenty of ants and beetles and other crawling creatures. But none of those creepy crawlies had been as big as his face and with hair nearly as long as his own. Cassie straightened and smiled at Sonia. "I'll hold her, Mommy. Can I hold Rosie?" "Okay, but you'll have to wait your turn," Sonia said. Cassie got in line behind a couple of other kids. Colton's eyes never left Rosie as first a boy, then a girl, held the enormous spider, and the zookeeper awarded the coveted stickers. In no time at all, Cassie's moment of truth arrived. Colton braced himself against my legs, close enough to see his sister, but trying to bolt at the same time, pushing back against my knees. Cassie held out her palm, and we all watched as Rosie, an old hand with small, curious humans, lifted one furry leg at a time and scurried across the bridge from the keeper's hand into Cassie's, then back into the keeper's. "You did it," the keeper said, as Sonia and I clapped and cheered. "Good job." Then the zookeeper stood, peeled a white and yellow sticker off a big roll, and gave it to Cassie. This, of course, made it even worse for Colton, who had not only been upstaged by his sister, but was now also the only stickerless Burpo kid. He gazed longingly at Cassie's prize, then back at Rosie, and I could see him trying to wrestle down his fear. Finally, he pursed his lips, dragged his gaze away from Rosie, and looked back up at me. "I don't want to hold her." "Okay," I said. "But can I have a sticker?" "Nope. The only way to get one is to hold her. Cassie did it. You can do it if you want to. Do you want to try? Just for a second?" Colton looked back at the spider, then at his sister, and I could see wheels turning behind his eyes. Cassie did it. She didn't get bit. Then he shook his head firmly. "No." "But I still want a sticker," he insisted. At the time, Colton was 2 months shy of 4 years old, and he was very good at standing his ground. "The only way you can get a sticker is if you hold Rosie," Sonia said. "Are you sure you don't want to hold her?" Colton answered by grabbing Sonia's hand and trying to tug her away from the keeper. "No, I want to go see the starfish." "Are you sure?" Sonia said. With a vigorous nod, Colton marched toward the Colosseum door. 2. Pastor Job. In the next room, we found rows of aquariums and indoor tide pools. We wandered around the exhibits, taking in starfish and mollusks and sea anemones that looked like underwater blossoms. Cassie and Colton oohed and awed as they dipped their hands in man-made tide pools and touched creatures that they had never seen. Next, we stepped into a massive atrium, bursting with jungle leaves, vines tumbling down, branches climbing toward the sky. I took in the palm trees and exotic flowers that looked as if they'd come from one of Colton's storybooks. And all around us, clouds of butterflies flitted and swirled. As the kids explored, I let my mind drift back to the summer before, when Sonia and I played in a co-ed softball league, like we do every year. We usually finished in the top 5, even though we played on the old folks team. Translation, people in their 30s. Battling teams made up of college kids. Now it struck me as ironic that our family's 7-month trial began with an injury that occurred in the last game of our last tournament of the 2002 season. I played center field, and Sonia played outfield rover. By then, Sonia had earned her master's degree in library science, and to me, was even more beautiful than when she'd first caught my eye as a freshman, strolling across the quad at Bartlesville Wesleyan College. Summer was winding down, but the dog days of the season were in full force with the penetrating heat, thirsty for rain. We had traveled from Imperial, about 20 miles down the road to the village of Juanita, for a double elimination tournament. At nearly midnight, we were battling our way up through the bracket, playing under the blue-white glow of the field lights. I don't remember what the score was, but I remember we were at the tail end of the game, and the lead was within reach. I had hit a double and was perched on second base. Our next batter came up and knocked a pitch that landed in the center field grass. I saw my chance. As an outfielder ran to scoop up the ball, I took off for third base. I sensed the ball winging toward the infield. Our third base coach motioned frantically, "Slide! Slide!" Adrenaline pumping, I dropped to the ground and felt the red dirt swooshing underneath my left hip. The other team's third baseman stretched out his glove hand for the ball and... crack! The sound of my leg breaking was so loud that I imagined the ball had zinged in from the outfield and smacked it. Fire exploded in my shin and ankle. I fell to my back, contracted into a fetal position, and pulled my knee up to my belly. The pain was searing, and I remember the dirt around me transforming into a blur of legs, the concerned faces, as two of our players, both EMTs, ran to my aid. I dimly remember Sonia rushing over to take a look. I could tell by her expression that my leg was bent in ways that didn't look natural. She stepped back to let our EMT friends get to work. A 20-mile ride later, hospital x-rays revealed a pair of nasty breaks. The tibia, the larger bone in my lower leg, had sustained what doctors call a spiral break, meaning that each end of the break looked like the barber pole pattern on a drill bit. Also, my ankle had snapped completely in half. That was probably the break I had heard. I later learned that the cracking sound was so loud that people sitting in the stands at first base heard it. That sound replayed in my head as Sonia and I watched Cassie and Colton scamper ahead of us in the Butterfly Pavilion atrium. The kids stopped on a small bridge and peered down into a koi pond, chattering and pointing. Clouds of butterflies floated around us, and I glanced at the brochure I'd bought at the front desk to see if I could tell their names. There were blue morphos with wings a deep aquamarine, black and white paper kites that flew slowly and gently like snippets of newsprint floating down through the air, and the cloudless sulfur, a tropical butterfly with wings the color of fresh mango. At this point, I was just happy to finally be able to walk without a limp. Besides the hacksaw pain of the spiral break, the most immediate effect of my accident was financial. It's pretty tough to climb up and down ladders to install garage doors while dragging a 10-pound cast and a knee that won't bend. Our bank balance took a sudden and rapid nosedive. On a blue-collar pastor's salary, what little reserve we had evaporated within weeks. Meanwhile, the amount we had coming in was chopped in half. The pain of that went beyond money, though. I served as both a volunteer firefighter and high school wrestling coach, commitments that suffered because of my bum leg. Sundays became a challenge, too. I'm one of those pastors who walks back and forth during the sermon, not a holy rolling fire and brimstone guy by any stretch, but not a soft-spoken minister in vestments performing liturgical readings either. I'm a storyteller. And to tell stories, I need to move around some. But now, I had to preach sitting down with my leg propped in a second chair, sticking out like the jib sail. Asking me to sit down while I delivered the Sunday message was like asking an Italian to talk without using his hands. But as much as I struggled with the inconvenience of my injury, I didn't know then that it would be only the first domino to fall. One morning that October, right about the time I'd gotten used to hobbling everywhere on crutches, I awoke to a dull throbbing in my lower back. I knew instantly what the problem was. Kidney stones. The first time I had a kidney stone, it measured 6 millimeters and required surgery. This time, after a round of tests, doctors thought the stones were small enough to pass. I don't know whether that was a good thing, though. I passed them for 3 days. I had once slammed my middle finger in a tailgate and cut the tip off. That was like baking cookies compared to this. Even breaking my leg into 4 pieces hadn't hurt as bad. Still, I survived. By November, I'd been hobbling around on crutches for 3 months, and I went in for a checkup. The leg's healing correctly, but we still need to keep it casted, the orthopedist said. Anything else bothering you? Actually, there was. I felt a little weird bringing it up, but the left side of my chest had developed a knot right beneath the surface of the nipple. I'm right-handed and had been leaning on my left crutch a lot while riding. So I thought maybe the underarm pad on that crutch had rubbed against my chest over a period of weeks, creating some kind of irritation beneath the skin, a callus of some kind. The doctor immediately ruled that out. Crutches don't do that, he said. I need to call a surgeon. The surgeon, Dr. Timothy O'Halloran, performed a needle biopsy. The results that came back a few days later shocked me. Hyperplasia. Translation? The precursor to breast cancer. Breast cancer? A man with a broken leg, kidney stones, and come on, really? Breast cancer? Later, when other pastors in my district got wind of it, they started calling me Pastor Job, after the man in the biblical book of the same name who was struck with a series of increasingly bizarre symptoms. For now, though, the surgeon ordered the same thing he would have if a woman's biopsy had come back with the same results, a lumpectomy. Strong, Midwestern woman that she is, Sonia took a practical approach to the news. If surgery was what the doctor ordered, that's the path we would walk. We'd get through it as a family. I felt the same way. But it was also about this time that I also started feeling sorry for myself. For one thing, I was tired of loping around on crutches. Also, a lumpectomy isn't exactly the manliest surgery in the world. Finally, I'd been asking the church board for a long time to set aside money for me for an assistant. Only after this second round of kidney stones did the board vote to authorize the position. Instead of feeling grateful as I should have, I indulged myself with resentment. So I have to be a cripple and be on the verge of a cancer diagnosis to get a little help around here? My pity party really got rolling one afternoon. I was down on the first floor of the church property, a finished basement really, where we had a kitchen, a classroom, and a large fellowship area. I had just finished up some paperwork and began working my way upstairs on my crutches. Down at the bottom, on the first step, I started getting mad at God. This isn't fair, I grumbled aloud as I struggled up the stairs, one crutch at a time, one step at a time. I have to suffer and be in this pathetic state for them to give me the help I've needed all along. Feeling pretty smug in my martyrdom, I had just reached the top landing when a still small voice arose in my heart. And what did my son do for you? Humbled and ashamed of my selfishness, I remembered what Jesus said to the disciples. A student is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. Sure, I'd had a rough few months, but they were nothing compared with what a lot of people in the world were going through, even at that very minute. God had blessed me with a small group of believers whom I was charged to shepherd and serve, and here I was griping at God because those believers weren't serving me. Lord, forgive me, I said, and swung forward with renewed strength, as if my crutches were eagle's wings. The truth was, my church was serving me, loving me through a special time of prayer they'd set aside. One morning in the beginning of December, Dr. O'Halloran called me at home with strange news. Not only was the tissue benign, it was entirely normal. Normal breast tissue. I can't explain why, he said. The biopsy definitely showed hyperplasia, so we would expect to see the same thing in the breast tissue removed during the lumpectomy. But the tissue was completely normal. I don't know what to say. I don't know how that happened. I knew. God had loved me with a little miracle. 3. Colton toughs it out. That next month, the cast came off. With the cancer scare and kidney stones behind us, I spent a couple of months learning to walk again. First with a walking cast, then with a pretty nasty limp, slowly working my atrophied muscles back to health again. By February, I finally achieved some independence, just in time for a district board meeting of our church denomination in Greeley, Colorado, set for the first week in March. "You need to get away," Sonia told me a couple of weeks before the board meeting. "Just get away and have a little fun." Now, here we were at the Butterfly Pavilion. A monarch butterfly fluttered past, its bright orange wings segmented in black like stained glass. I breathed a prayer of thanks that our trip had happened at all. 2 days before, on Thursday, Colton had begun telling Sonia that his stomach hurt. I was already in Greeley, and at the time, Sonia was teaching a Title I class at Imperial High School. Not wanting to put the school to the expense of a substitute, she asked our good friend, Norma Donat, if she could watch Colton at her home so that Sonia could go to work. Norma, who was like a favorite aunt to our kids, immediately said yes. But at midday, Sonia's cell phone rang. It was Norma. Colton's condition had taken a nosedive. He had a fever with chills, and for most of the morning had lain nearly motionless on Norma's couch, wrapped in a blanket. "He says he's freezing, but he's sweating like crazy," Norma said, clearly concerned. She said Colton's forehead was covered in beads of sweat, as big as teardrops. Norma's husband Brian had come home, taken one look, and decided Colton was sick enough that he should go to the emergency room. Sonia called me in Greeley with the news, and just like that, I saw our trip to celebrate the end of a string of injury and illness being canceled by illness. Sonia checked out of work early, scooped up Colton from Norma's house, and took him to the doctor, who revealed that a stomach flu was working its way around town. Through that night, our trip remained up in the air. Separately, in Greeley and Imperial, Sonia and I prayed that Colton would feel well enough to make the trip, and by morning, we got our answer. Yes. During the night, Colton's fever broke, and by afternoon on Friday, he was his old self again. Sonia called to tell me, "We're on our way." Now, at the Butterfly Pavilion, Sonia checked her watch. We were scheduled to meet Steve Wilson, the pastor of Greeley Wesleyan Church, and his wife Rebecca for dinner that evening, and the kids still wanted to get in a swim at the hotel pool. There was zero chance of them swimming in Imperial in March, so this was a rare opportunity. "Okay, we should probably head back to the hotel," Sonia said. I looked at her and then at Colton. "Hey, bud, it's time to go. Are you still sure you don't want to hold Rosie?" I said. "Last chance to get a sticker. What do you think?" Emotions played over Colton's face like sunshine in clouds in a fast-moving weather front. By now, even his big sister had been ribbing him a little about being afraid. As I watched, Colton narrowed his eyes and set his jaw. He wanted that sticker. "Okay, I'll hold her," he said. "But just for a little bit." Before he could change his mind, we all trooped back into the Coliseum, and I corralled the keeper. "This is Colton, and he wants to give it a try," I said. The keeper smiled and bent down. "Okay, Colton, are you ready?" Stiff as a board, our son held out his hand, and I bent over and cradled it in my own. "Now, this is super easy, Colton," the keeper said. "Just hold your hand out flat and still. Rosie is very gentle. She won't hurt you." The keeper raised his hand, and Rosie sidled over to Colton's hand and back to the keeper's waiting hand on the other side, never even slowing down. We all broke into cheers and clapped for Colton as the keeper handed him his sticker. He had faced his fear. It was a big victory for him. The moment seemed like icing on the cake of a perfect day. As we left the Butterfly Pavilion, I reflected back over the past several months. It was hard to believe that the broken leg, the kidney stones, the lost work, the financial stress, 3 surgeries, and the cancer scare had all happened in half a year's time. In that moment, I realized for the first time that I had been feeling like I'd been in a fight. For months, I'd had my guard up, waiting for the next punch life could throw. Now, though, I felt completely relaxed for the first time since the previous summer. If I'd let my mind roll with that boxing metaphor just a little longer, I might have followed it to its logical conclusion. In a boxing match, the fighters absorb some vicious blows because they're ready for them, and usually the knockout punch is the one they didn't see coming. 4. Smoke signals. Later that evening, with the swim under their belts, Cassie and Colton sat in a big round booth at the old Chicago restaurant in Greeley, Colorado, coloring happily while Sonia and I chatted with Pastor Steve Wilson and his wife Rebecca. We had already chowed down on some terrific Italian food, including the usual kid favorites, pizza, spaghetti, and garlic bread. Steve was senior pastor of a church of between 1,500 and 2,000 people, nearly as many people as lived in our hometown of Imperial. It was a chance for Sonia and me to get to know another pastor in our district and to get some ideas on how other pastors do ministry. We planned to visit Steve's church, Greeley Wesleyan, the next day. Sonia especially wanted to get a look at how the church's Sunday morning children's program worked. Rebecca divided her time between the grown-up conversation and coloring with the kids. "Wow, Colton, you're doing a really good job coloring that pizza," she said. Colton offered a thin, polite smile, but had fallen unusually quiet. Then, a few minutes later, he said, "Mommy, my tummy hurts." Sonia and I exchanged a glance. Was it the stomach flu coming back? Sonia laid the back of her hand against Colton's cheek and shook her head. "You don't feel hot, hun." "I think I'm gonna throw up," Colton said. "I don't feel so good either, Mommy," Cassie said. We figured it was something they ate. With both kids feeling under the weather, we ended our dinner early, said goodbye to the Wilsons, and headed back to the hotel, which was just across the parking lot from the restaurant. As soon as we got the door to our room open, Colton's prediction came true. He upchucked, beginning on the carpet and ending, as Sonia whisked him into the tiny bathroom, in the toilet. Standing in the bathroom doorway, I watched Colton's small form bent over and convulsing. This didn't seem like any kind of food poisoning. "Gotta be that stomach flu," I thought. Great. That was how the evening began. It continued with Colton throwing up every 30 minutes like clockwork. Between times, Sonia sat in an unupholstered side chair with Colton on her lap, keeping the room's ice bucket within reach in case she couldn't make it to the bathroom. About 2 hours into this cycle, another kid joined the party. As Colton was in the bathroom, heaving into the toilet with Sonia kneeling beside him, a steadying hand on his back, Cassie ran in and threw up in the tub. "Todd," Sonia called, "I need a little help in here." Great, I thought. Now they both have it. Or did they? After we were able to move both kids back to the bedroom, Sonia and I put our heads together. Colton had seemed to kick that stomach flu the day before. And all day long at the Butterfly Pavilion, he was his normal self, completely happy, except for the strain of holding Rosie to get that sticker. Cassie had held Rosie, too. Could Goliath tarantulas trigger a case of double upchuck? No, dummy, I told myself, and pushed the thought aside. "Did the kids eat the same thing at the restaurant?" I asked Sonia, who by then was lying on one of the double beds with one arm around each of our two green-at-the-gills kids. She looked at the ceiling and thought for a moment. "I think they both had some pizza, but we all had pizza. I think it's that flu. Colton probably wasn't over it quite yet, and he passed it along to Cassie before we got here. The doctor said it was pretty contagious." No matter what, it looked like our relaxing post-turmoil celebration trip was abruptly coming to an end. And a few minutes later, I heard the magic words that seemed to confirm my thoughts. "Mommy, I feel like I'm gonna throw up again." Sonia snatched up Colton and hustled him to the toilet again, just in the nick of time. When the pink light of dawn began peeking through the curtains the next morning, Sonia was still awake. We had agreed that at least one of us should still go visit Greeley Wesleyan and get some large church ministry knowledge we could export to Imperial. so I tried to get at least a little sleep. That left Sonia with nursing duties, which included an almost hourly trek back and forth to the bathroom with Colton. Cassie had gotten sick only one other time during the night. But whatever this bug was, it seemed to have latched onto our little boy's innards and dug in deep. We checked out of the hotel early and drove over to the Greeley home of Phil and Betty Lou Harris, our close friends and also superintendents for the Wesleyan Church District that includes all of Colorado and Nebraska. The original plan had been that our two families would attend the Wilson's Church together that morning. Now, though, with a pair of sick kids, we decided that Sonia would stay at the Harris's home. Betty Lou, sweet lady that she is, volunteered to stay home and assist. When I got back from church just after lunch, Sonia gave me the status report. Cassie was feeling a lot better. She had even been able to eat a little something and keep it down. But Colton continued to vomit on a clockwork basis and had been unable to hold anything down. Colton was in the Harris's living room, huddled in the corner of the huge couch on top of a blanket slash drop cloth with a bucket standing nearby just in case. I walked over and sat down beside him. "Hey, buddy. Not doing so great, huh?" Colton slowly shook his head, and tears welled up in his blue eyes. I might have been in my 30s, but over the last few months, I'd learned only too well what it was like to feel so sick and miserable that you just wanted to cry. My heart hurt for my son. "Come here," I said. I pulled him into my lap and looked into his little round face. His eyes, usually sparkling and playful, looked flat and weak. Phil walked over and sat down beside me and reviewed the symptoms. Abdominal pain, profuse vomiting, a fever that had come and gone. Could it be appendicitis? I thought about it for a moment. There was certainly a family history. My uncle's appendix had burst, and I'd had a wicked case of appendicitis in college during the time Sonia and I were dating. Also, Sonia had had her appendix out when she was in second grade. But the circumstances here didn't seem to fit the bill. The doctor in Imperial had diagnosed him with stomach flu. And if it was appendicitis, there would be no reason Cassie would be sick too. We spent Sunday night with the Harrises in Greeley. By morning, Cassie had completely recovered, but Colton had spent a second night throwing up. As we packed our duffel bags and headed outside to load up the expedition, Phil gazed at Colton, cradled in Sonia's arms. "He looks pretty sick to me, Todd. Maybe you should take him to the hospital here." Sonia and I had discussed that option. We had sat in emergency waiting areas with the sick kid before, and our experience was that we could probably make the 3-hour drive back to Imperial before we would be seen in the emergency room of a Metro Denver hospital. So instead, we called ahead to Imperial and made an appointment with our regular family doctor, the one Colton had seen the previous Friday. I explained our reasoning to Phil. He said he understood, but I could tell he was still worried. And by the time we'd been on the road for an hour or so, I began to think maybe he had been right. For Sonia, our first red flag waved when we stopped at a Safeway just outside Greeley to buy pull-ups. Colton, who had been potty trained for more than 2 years, had tinkled in his underwear. It worried Sonia that he didn't even protest when she laid him down in the back seat of the expedition and helped him into a pair of pull-ups. Under normal circumstances, he would have been indignant. "I'm not a baby!" Now, though, he didn't utter a peep. Instead, once strapped back into his car seat, he only clutched his belly and moaned. 2 hours into the drive, he was crying constantly, stopping about every 30 minutes to throw up again. In the rearview mirror, I could see the heartbreak and helplessness on Sonia's face. Meanwhile, I tried to focus on the goal. Get him to Imperial. Get some IVs in him. Stop the dehydration that surely must be setting in as this flu ran its course. We reached Imperial in just under 3 hours. At the hospital, a nurse took us back to an examination room pretty quickly, with Sonia carrying Colton, cradling his head against her shoulder the way she had when he was an infant. Within a few minutes, the doctor who had seen Colton on Friday joined us, and we brought him up to date on the situation. After a brief exam, he ordered blood tests and an x-ray, and I think I took a breath for the first time since we rolled out of Greeley. This was progress. We were doing something. In a short while, we'd have a diagnosis, probably a prescription or two, and Colton would be on the way to recovery. We took Colton to the lab, where he screamed as a tech tried her best to find a vein. That was followed by x-rays that were better only because we convinced Colton that there were no needles involved. Within an hour, we were back in the exam room with the doctor. "Could it be appendicitis?" Sonia asked the doctor. He shook his head. "No, Colton's white blood cell count isn't consistent with appendicitis. We are concerned, though, about his x-rays." I looked at Sonia. It was at that moment we realized we'd been banking on a really nasty virus. We were completely unprepared for something more serious. The doctor led us into the hallway, where there was already an x-ray clipped to an illuminator. When I saw what was in the picture, my heart dropped into my stomach. The x-ray of our son's tiny little torso showed three dark masses. It looked for all the